A massive restructuring of the federal tax code is gathering momentum in Congress amid conflicting reports of its potential impact. What's clear is that some will benefit, some will be hurt. The question is who? Victor Geminiani is the founder and co-director of the Hoy Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice, and he's here to look at the Republican tax bill and its possible effects on Hawaii. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning. Thanks for having us, Chris.
First of all, is this going to happen?
Well, that'll be decided the next couple of days. If you see it start to unravel today or tomorrow or during the Friday hearings, and they actually have the hearings and go for a vote, yes. If they start to delay it, as they did with the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, because they just don't have the votes, it'll start to unravel because we have a very little time left in the session with so many things to do, including the federal closure that may will come take place on December 8th. So they had a lot of work on their plate. If they can't jam this thing through, I think, to be frank with you, if they get headwinds, it'll fall by the wayside, although there'll be a lot of energy to continue it because of the promises that have been made.
What would take to unravel? It would take a couple of Republicans defecting, right?
Three. You need three. You've got to get past 50. At 50, if you lose two and you're at a 50-50 vote, then Vice President Pence will come in with the deciding vote.
Yeah.
It's a travesty, in my opinion, that we're pushing through a major, major, major policy change like this with virtually no discussion and without even any kind of majority, even a simple majority in the Senate, where the Vice President actually has to come in and step in and throw his support for where they're going.
We've seen far less significant measures take far longer to go through Congress, haven't we?
Absolutely.
Years.
The Affordable Care Act went through for two and a half, three years with many, 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 many hearings. This has gone through in about 30, 35 days, no hearings at all. And to be frank with you, the great majority of people, even in Congress, have no clue what are the idiosyncrasies in this on these two plans, one from the House, one from the Senate. A lot of little things tucked in there. For example, there's a $14 billion a giveaway to fossil fuel industry. At the same time, they're cutting all of the renewable energy credits. So there's lots of little things that are filtered all the way through this bill that people have no clue about until they really dig deeply in the weeds, and we just don't have time.
Isn't it likely that people are going to be hurt who thought they were going to benefit?
Oh. There's no doubt about that. In fact, I think people understand that now. The polls show that only about 30% of the people in the country support this bill, either bill, House or Senate. So the fact of the matter is there's a lot of people out there that were hoping that this would be a middle-class tax relief as the president promised and as Congress promised. And as turned, it's really not going to happen at all. In fact, a lot of people are going to be taxed that are under $75,000, $80,000. There was a report just issued, I think, by CBO yesterday, Congressional Budget Office, that said those earning $75,000 or less are going to see their taxes stay the same or go up.
It's been billed as middle-class tax relief. That's the only reason it's gotten so far, right?
But if you're a communication major, you understand that you bill what you can get through. You frame it in a way that ultimately will gather the support and hope that people don't remember what the promises were made when 3 or 4 or 5 years you have another tax increase to pay for the deficits, or you have significant program cuts to the things that are core to our values, education, housing, health, things of that nature.
If something as fundamental as a tax bill is about to go through with only 30% of the country supporting it, something's gone a little kablooey in the democratic process, right?
I would say it is driven to a large extent by those who donate money to the political parties. The big givers are, to a large extent, the ones that are telling the Republicans get this thing through, primarily because of the benefits, significant benefits to the corporate tax rate. So the Republicans ultimately have to perform if they're going to ultimately continue the support from the people they hope to get support from, including the Republicans. Some Republicans are worried about being primaried, so they're going to have oppositions if they don't support this plan, and they'll be primaried and potentially lose the primary, and they'll be out of office.
Primaried as in the administration and the party is going to support a primary opponent and knock them out of their box?
Exactly. And obviously Arizona is front and center with that, with Flake, as is Tennessee, with Corker both resigning. Those seats are now open, and there will be more likely people that are going to be at least entering the race that are far more conservative than both of those representatives.
If I'm a Republican member of Congress, either House or Senate, and a lot of people are telling me, as you are, that a majority of my constituents are going to be hurt, isn't this going to backfire on me as an office
holder? We will know that in 218 and 220. The problem with these types of issues—
By which time it's too late.
Exactly. Exactly. You don't know until the voters have a chance to actually weigh in. And again, since there have been no hearings and this being jammed through in 30, 35 days, people haven't really been had a chance to understand what's happening in their lives through this bill and mobilize. So therefore, when it's jammed through, you just hope that people ultimately forget that you supported that bill and leave the day with a happy feeling because they're going to get theoretically tax relief until they find out they don't.
What, you know, let's just assume for a minute that I'm a staunch advocate of this tax reform bill. What would be my rejoinder to what you're saying to me now? What's the counter argument?
The counter argument basically is the old trickle down economics that was invented and introduced into our political thinking by Ronald Reagan when he was president. It basically says that the economy will significantly improve because of the creation of jobs. You'll have all of this money going into corporations that will reinvest both in worker salaries as well as reinvest in the product development, bring the jobs home from a variety of other places that they are because the rates are still low, and therefore generate a lot of economic vitality. And we will not only create jobs and energy in our economy, but we'll also not have a deficit because the revenues raised will eliminate any deficit that's projected. A $1.5 trillion deficit will disappear. That's shabai, to use an old Hawaiian word. That's, in my opinion, total fraud.
An FCC
it doesn't happen.
Word.
It's never happened. You can have people come in and say it will happen. Their projections in terms of the economic vitality that will be pumped in are way past whatever we've experienced and whatever we'll be able to accomplish. So their projections on economic vitality are high, showing that they can get rid of deficits. But the bottom line is the reality doesn't happen. And I'll remind you one more thing. We have had now 9 years since the big recession, the Great Recession. Theoretically, we have recessions every 10, 11, 9, 8 years. We're well past the time when we can predict a recession. So when you have a recession and you at the same time have massive budget deficits that are going on, you have two alternatives. You either raise taxes, which most people don't like to do. And I'll remind you, Ronald Reagan did that, even though he promised economic vitality and the deficit would pay for themselves. When it was clear they wouldn't, he was forced to raise taxes. To his credit, George Bush didn't do that. George Bush significantly decreased programs in the country, and you can see that in any kind of line chart when you take a look at what happened to education, housing, et cetera. So bottom line is the trickle-down theory really doesn't work. In fact, I think the Congressional Budget Office has indicated that only about 25% of the revenue is going to be saved by corporations will go into workers' pockets. The rest will be spent on profit-making or some reinvestment.
Well, for a wealthy individual or a wealthy corporation, what are the incentives to create more jobs, more American-based jobs? Isn't it aren't you likely to be more profitable by outsourcing a lot of what you do?
That has been,
pattern, right?
Donald Trump does it himself in the import of his workforce and where he buys a lot of his material from that he markets. That's a natural. If you're trying to maximize profit, you can look for the cheapest market you possibly can in creating that market. Then you have to worry about, obviously, tariffs that come up from the country if you're producing elsewhere. So,
that is definitely
an incentive. It's always going to be an incentive. The people that support this bill would say there's less of an incentive because the taxes are significantly lower in our country than they are elsewhere. I think there's also a provision that taxes foreign investments and foreign resources that you produce, profits you make at the same rate. So if both internal to the country and external foreign profits are taxed the same, I don't think there's much of an incentive to bring jobs home. You still look for where you're going to make the greatest amount of profit, and unfortunately it's in developing countries.
We're looking at a very different country when this passes, if this passes, aren't we, Victor?
To be frank, the tragedy in this bill is the same tragedy that I saw in the Reagan cuts and the Bush cuts. The promise that you're going to get something for nothing just does not happen in reality, and that ultimately we're going to be faced with, again, another round of massive cuts. And by the way, in this bill, if this bill passes, there's already built in $338 billion of Medicaid cuts over the next 10 years also. So you're going to see, in my opinion, in the next 2 or 3 years, one of two things, either a increase in taxes, taking back what they gave for a short period of time, or a significant decrease in programs. And I would suspect, depending upon who's in government, you're going to see a decrease in programs. And to be frank with you, when we look around our lives, we need investments all over in our schools and our healthcare systems and our infrastructure. We just can't do that the more we continue to cut taxes and build up deficits and then go back and cut programs further to pay for those deficits.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Can't say that you've cheered me up, but that's not really your job, is it? Thanks, Victor.
I wish it was, and I wish I could.
Victor Gemiani is the founder and co-director of the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. The House version of the tax reform bill contains a provision that is troubling to many nonprofit and faith-based organizations, a repeal of the Johnson Amendment, a 1954 measure that says they should not endorse political candidates or have the ability to run money through their organizations for political gain. According to Lisa Murayama, president and CEO of the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations, the proposal, which could be the law of the land by Christmas, could threaten the separation of church and state and the very survival of nonprofits.
I think that this is a really, really scary move for the House to make. Basically, what this does is really muddy the missions of charitable nonprofits as well as churches. I think that if your organization is being used as a vessel for the pass-through of potentially dark money, used for political endorsement, for electioneering, then for your average constituent that relies on the very critical mission-based work that your organization is doing, there becomes a question in the minds of donors and constituents as to what the true intentions are of those charitable nonprofits. I think up until now, it's been very clear that mission-based work has been very pure. And any kind of weakening or repeal of the Johnson Amendment erodes that trust, that integrity that nonprofit, charitable nonprofits, foundations, and churches have always upheld in our communities nationwide.
Making it possible for me to say, I'm going to give you $1 million, you a nonprofit, if you will hew this particular
political
line.
Absolutely. Can you imagine the conversations in a boardroom where you've got board members no longer just interested in furthering or advancing your mission, but come with political affiliations on both sides, any kinds of political affiliations, mm-hmm. and trying to motivate the actions of the board and the staff toward some kind of political gain? Those conversations will no longer be true. They'll
be
colored.
In a note to us, you described this, the original intent of the Johnson Amendment, as protecting churches and nonprofits from politics. It also seems as if we need to protect politics from them, in a sense.
Absolutely, right. I mean, these have been great excuses for nonprofits to not have to get involved, to stay out of the fray,
yeah.
really. And for there to be no question as to their nonpartisanship. And we already have a lot of preoccupations already, survival, financial challenges, capacity issues. We can't lay over into that political, politics, basically, to further complicate things.
Does this hit right at the foundation, the notion of the separation of church and state?
That too, and really the very existence of our tax-exempt status, I think, that we've been designated for years. It calls into question, the community good that we are doing currently should exempt us from having to be involved in those types of activities. So it is very foundational.
Most of the time, nonprofits, tax-exempt status is the only reason they can function.
Right, right. And, actually, some of the opponents of any change to the Johnson Amendment have actually said that there's quite a bit of money that will be lost by the federal government, actually, if donors who previously were paying taxes on political donations and contributions will now look to nonprofit vehicles as tax shelters where they no longer need to pay. So the revenue that the federal government will receive will decrease significantly if everybody is looking for these nonprofit vehicles in which to put their, place their money.
This seems to go against past Republican, and this is a Republican notion, this repeal, right? And yet it
largely,
seems to
yes.
go against past Republican notions. I'm thinking of Bush Sr. and the 1,000 Points of Light saying that nonprofits will now take care of the social safety net. This seems to work against that, no?
I think so, too, yes. I think this is really a minority voice of right evangelical perspectives that really want to see, in their eyes, freedom of speech, the ability to preach from the pulpit, to endorse from the pulpit, and to have more play and say in the political environment with the money that they can then raise.
Given that this is a minority view, why does it have such a good chance of passage? It seems to me there's a pretty much a groundswell of opposition. Or is there?
There is a groundswell of opposition. Thank you. Yes. Most people are opposed to any kind of tampering with the Johnson Amendment. And yet somehow this actually harks back to the National Prayer Breakfast, in which President Trump actually said that he wanted to, you know, totally destroy the Johnson Amendment to give more voice to churches. And there are now several vehicles going forward in Congress. The latest has actually been embedded in the tax reform package out of the House. It does not exist on the Senate side as of yet. And so because the deliberations are currently in the Senate, where there is no change, we really want there to be voices from the community, from communities across the country, to really voice their support of the Johnson Amendment to keep it intact.
Has that happened from Hawaii nonprofits?
Yes, actually. So there had been our national office, the National Council of Nonprofits, initiated a letter-writing campaign. 5,500 organizations have signed on to keep the Johnson Amendment intact, including about 100 nonprofits or organizations from Hawaii. And there has been representation from every state in the country to keep the Johnson Amendment intact.
It goes back to when? It's named after Lyndon Johnson when he was a Texas senator.
Yes, then Senator Lyndon B. Johnson made this amendment in 1954, actually, and basically, very clearly, to keep nonprofits and churches out of politics.
Has it been challenged between then and now?
I don't think so. No, it's been untouched.
I'm just wondering why it became such an issue in such a short time.
Well, again, I think it's because of some of the statements that were made by President Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast, making, you know, a mandate that he would like to see the Johnson Amendment, you know, basically go away.
Just in terms of strategy, thinking about Republican strategy, I'm wondering if this could backfire on them, because they're kind of getting under the covers with a pretty volatile community, the evangelical community.
Sure.
And banking on their approval.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of money, I guess, in some of the mega churches that exist around the country. And so there's maybe this eye toward more, you know, being able to raise more for the political coffers, for the campaign coffers. And maybe that has something to do with it. I really don't know. The sponsor of some of the bills has been Senator Langford out of Oklahoma, and he's a former pastor. So some of the architects of some of these bills going forward in Congress actually have this kind of faith-based experience.
With mega churches as a large economic
possibly, right,
factor.
With their eye toward megachurches. I'm not sure. And it's very interesting, the dynamics going on right now. And it's very dangerous that it's being implanted within the tax reform package. There are so many other troubling aspects of that tax reform package as they affect nonprofits. But this one potentially can be pretty fundamentally earth-shattering, I think, for the nonprofit industry.
Could be law of the land by Christmas, right?
The fear is that they're going very fast, and the Senate actually has the ability to pass this out by the end of this week. They're debating it now on the Senate floor, mm-hmm. but they hope to get it to President Trump by Christmas for his signing. So ridiculously fast, without any ability by advocates to weigh in and to see how the sausage is being made, actually. And so it's very worrisome. Again, there is a difference between the House and Senate version, but there is a conference kind of committee that will happen over the next couple of weeks where all of that will be sorted out. And the fear is that any kind of weakening to the Johnson Amendment will pop up in the final version. So we need to be vigilant.
And the fear, unless what happens? I mean, there's a
if the final version does not have any kind of attempt to weaken the Johnson Amendment, then I think basically we are just talking about tax reform. You know, we're not talking about these other types of add-ons. And so we just have to look to see what those conversations are around this particular amendment.
Lisa Murayama is the president and CEO of the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations. You can learn more about the Johnson Amendment on the Conversations Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, going after agricultural theft on Hawaii Island. But first, your quiz. In our backyard today, we gaze out over the spectacular north-facing cliffs of Molokai, averaging over 2,000 feet high. Just about in the center of the island, as you look down from this pali, you see the isolated Kalaupapa Peninsula spreading out beneath you, a broad, rounded triangle covering about 6 square miles. It consisted of 4 populated ahupuaha in ancient days, but after 1865, Kamehameha V authorized an act forcibly isolating sufferers of Hansen's disease, known at that time as maipake, or leprosy, to the peninsula. Kalaupapa then gained its infamous reputation as the place where lepers were sent to die. The redeeming compassion of Father Damien's ministry to the lepers changed the perception of this place from a hell on earth to a place of peace and hope. And today, as we look at this famous peninsula, we're asking if you know why it's called Kalaupapa and what that name means. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. Molokai Kahana on Oahu's north shore is a rare place of refuge in a crowded island where locals and visitors can rent beachside cabins to get away from it all. That's likely to change if the Church of Latter-day Saints, which owns much of the land in that part of the island through its economic arm, Hawaii's Reserves, gets its way. It has plans to build more than 500 new housing units at Molokai Kahana, and Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton has that story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good. 550 new units would meet a community need. It's Laie is known as an overcrowded community, right? But it really would change that community quite a bit, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. And that's the sort of tension that's going on up there. You know, if you look at census data, for instance, it's very crowded. You know, we're talking about maybe 1,000 or 1,100 housing units for about 6,100 people, and about half of the households there have 4 or more people living there. And, you know, we hear anecdotal reports of like 8 people living in a house. So it is crowded. But the question is, well, what to do about it?
Well, 550 units would certainly alleviate that, but it would also change the character of the shoreline, wouldn't it?
Well, that's the thought, and really the push is, and what's going on now is there is a bill before the city council that would essentially keep the country, keep Molokai Kahana, where the Mormon Church wants to develop or has targeted for development. It would keep that as ag land and really, again, keep it the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
The church is pushing back, saying, well, we want to be able to build more housing, and that's a place. There's a meeting tonight at Haula to discuss this at the elementary school there. So this bill that's been pending for a while, it looks like it's getting some traction and might be moving forward.
Is that
and
meeting...
that would keep it country. That would keep the country, as they say.
If the bill goes forward.
Yes.
Is that likely meeting tonight likely to be a contentious one?
I think so. I mean, what I'm hearing from both sides is a lot of people are interested in it, and there will be a lot of people there.
And council members in attendance to?
Yes, it's a committee of the city council that's hearing the bill. It's Ekaika Anderson is the chair, and Ernest Martin is the council member out there. So Councilman Anderson is the one who sort of organized this and has called it. And, of course, Councilman Martin is very interested since it's his district.
In the background of all this is the enormous economic power of the Mormon, the LDS Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints, through Hawaii Reserve, which is, as I understand it, it's kind of its economic arm, yeah?
Yes. Here we have Hawaii Reserves. They have other arms on the mainland and Utah and other places. And, again, it is a very big business operation. They have, as you mentioned, they have Hawaii Reserves here, and that has shopping center in Laie. It runs a lot of the things in Laie. It's very, very big and powerful there. We have the Polynesian Cultural Center. Again, it's about a $70 million operation in revenue. It's tax exempt. They have operations on the mainland in Utah. They own, you know, TV stations. A publishing arm owns the Deseret News newspaper in Salt Lake City. They've recently built the City Creek Center, this big mall in downtown Salt Lake City. One scholar who studied this says that he estimates that the church's revenue, with including tithings and revenue from all these businesses, equals $50 billion a year, which seems enormous. But this scholar has a lot of credibility and has been looking at this for a long time. So,
well, money's power, right? Thanks a lot, Stuart, for talking with us. We'll look to see what news comes out of this hearing tonight. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. Agriculture plays a major role in the economy of Hawaii Island, but that industry has had a problem for years, theft. Farmers across the island growing a variety of different crops have seen their crops stolen from fields and orchards. Those thefts are difficult to trace and even harder to prosecute. Authorities in state and local government play a constant game of cat and mouse with criminals. And as part of our week-long look at the issue, Hawaii County Prosecuting Attorney Mitch Roth spoke with conversation producer Ryan Finnerty to discuss his latest efforts to address agriculture theft.
Agriculture theft has been a big problem on the Big Island. When you look at the Big Island, we are an agricultural community, and you know, we have a lot of land. We should be able to produce enough food to feed our schools, to feed our people, but we're bringing in a lot of stuff. A couple of years back, well, probably about 10, 15 years back, we were looking at some problems that the farmers were bringing up to me. And actually started with some of the farmers who were growing like longan, lychee, rambutan. They were telling me that some people at the farmers market were selling stolen agricultural product. And it's like, well, how do you know it's stolen? And they said basically that the price that they were selling it for at that time was cheaper than the farmers could even sell it. So we started looking into these people who were selling some of these agricultural goods, and we asked where they came from. When we started asking them, we were getting things like, oh, we got it from these local guys. And we asked, do you have a name? And they said, oh, no names. Well, then we asked for some descriptions, and we got, local guys between 5'6" and 6'2", which, for us, brought down the suspect pool to half the island. But right around the same time that was happening, there was the first case of mad cow disease that hit the United States. It was in Washington State. And we're listening as they're able to track that cow or the calves back to where they came from in Canada. And we thought, wow, that makes a lot of sense. You should be able to track your food back, because it's something. Somebody's getting sick from something, you want to know where that food came from. And so we went to the Farm Bureau, and the Farm Bureau went to the legislature, and they started asking to make some laws. And one of the laws that came up was movement certificates that requires people to have a pretty much a receipt on where the products came from. And that law got passed. We started having the community police officers and Department of Agriculture, when they could, go out and start making checks. We did some education. Crime went down. Times went by. Criminals got a little bit smarter, and you know, we started doing it, and then there was some receipts, but not very much information on the receipts. And so we went back to the legislature a couple of times, and the legislature required that there'd be receipts for, you know, any agriculture that's moved over a certain poundage. I think it's over 200 pounds or worth more than $100, and also a movement certificate for when you're selling products or you have more than $100 worth of value or 200 pounds. Some of the requirements on the agriculture certificates also require a license and ID from the person who was selling it and the location where the property was coming from. And so we started looking at that, and a couple of years back we looked at a pilot project where we tried to run through the legislature to get an agricultural investigator just to work on agricultural crimes. And we made it through the legislature a couple of times, but kind of stopped shy of actually passing a bill. Last year, we hired an agricultural investigator, Shane Muramaro, and that's his job. 100% of his time is spent educating people, looking at receipts, making sure that people are doing the right things. And if we need to make cases, we're going to be making cases for, you know, whether it be theft in the second degree or other agricultural crimes when people don't have the required certificates that they need.
So that seems like a lot of paperwork for one person to look through. Is one inspector enough to adequately ensure that stolen property, stolen crops are not being sold on the market?
Well, we could always use more of everybody, but I think in the very beginning, what we're trying to do is we're trying to educate people, because a lot of people have not been giving movement certificates. And, you know, it makes it difficult. So we're trying to educate our farmers at this point. We're trying to educate the people who are selling the agricultural goods. And we're trying to cut the market off. So if we can do that, we can reduce a lot of the crime that's happened or happening in our community.
Mitch, we've been looking at coffee, the theft of coffee on the Kona Coast all this week. But it's my understanding that agricultural theft is not limited to just coffee. Are there any particular crops or regions of Hawaii Island that experience worse agricultural theft than others?
Yeah, you know, coffee, it's not limited to coffee. We have lychee is one of the big crops that gets ripped off, or longan, rambutan, all the same family. Bananas have been a problem. Pineapples, you know, if people have a, you know, if they see ways of making money, they're going to take those opportunities. And so basically, we're trying to cut off the market. With coffee, we've been dealing with coffee for many years, and coffee has changed dramatically. When I first came to this island, we were looking at coffee theft, and one of the things that we looked at was the way things were happening. In coffee, what we used to see was that, you know, the farmers would pick their coffee, they'd leave the bags on the side of the road, and then we'd have these people who are stealing the coffee and bringing them to the processors. The processors were then paying in cash. For a long time, we were able to stem a lot of that coffee theft by going to the processors and asking them to pay with check. So we were able to find who the people were who were stealing it. And that worked for a long time. We eventually started having people who started paying cash again for coffee, and it started to be a problem again. With coffee, the rules are the same. You need to have a movement certificate. You need to be able to determine where that coffee came from. There's actually bigger problems with coffee because we have counterfeiting coffee. That may sound crazy, but Kona Coffee is a brand name that's one of the best known coffees in the world, one of the most expensive coffees. If you take some other coffee and mix it in and call it 100% Kona coffee, you have the ability to destroy that market because the quality would not be as good as it is. And so we've taken the coffee thefts very seriously. It could affect numerous people on Hawaii, and there's a lot of people that's their second income. The income that helps bring them, you know, through the tough times is growing coffee on their property. Right now, Kona coffee it's very expensive, and so it brings in a lot of money. If that quality was to not be as great as it was, then the amount people pay for Kona coffee would be diminished, and we'd have some big problems.
So, Mitch, we spoke to a coffee farmer earlier in the week, Adria McClish. She's in the South Kona area, and she's in a very rural her farm is in a very rural area, which is, I'm sure, the case for many farmers on the Big Island. What are some of the challenges associated with helping these farmers in really rural areas when you have limited resources and limited police? And it sounds like your efforts are focused on preventing crimes from occurring. But for people in these rural areas that are dealing with them, what's the best way to help them?
And, you know, that's why we went to an investigator. Crime is like water. It takes the path of least resistance. And so if you can take the market away by preventing people from selling it, you're going to prevent people from stealing the coffee or stealing the other crops because they're in a remote area. Most of our farms are remote. And quite frankly, for a lot of law enforcement and prosecutors alike, it's not that sexy prosecuting these crimes, but it's so important because a lot of our community is affected, and it really is, you know, has a great effect on commerce.
As Ms. Roth mentioned, his office created a new position earlier this year, Agriculture Crimes Investigator. That job is held by Shane Morimaro, who explained why ag theft is so difficult to prosecute and what statutes are in place to prevent it.
Well, there's an Agricultural Commodities Ownership Movement certification, which is Chapter 145-22, and that's when you're transporting agricultural commodities of over 200 pounds or a value of at least $100, you're going to need a movement certificate or like a bill of lading, a receipt, and it must include like the seller's name, address, telephone numbers, license plates of the vehicles used by the seller, and name of the farm, owner, place of origin, and the name of the buyer if it goes through a broker.
So, Shane, what's to stop someone who has stolen coffee or lychee or any other product from forging that information?
Well, see, if they have, when there's no information, it's really hard to investigate. If they have false information, then we can prove it's false, then we can move forward from there.
So, Shane, if your office receives a report of a farmer of any crop reporting a theft, what's the first thing you do when you receive a tip like that?
They would need to contact the police first and do the initial investigation. If it's like, because we have gotten calls from different areas of the island. I'm based out of Hilo right now. And so most of our crimes on this island are reported to the police first to do an initial investigation and go from there.
Are there any particular regions of the island that see more incidents of theft than others?
It appears that agricultural crimes are not reported as much as the regular crimes. I'm not sure the exact reason why. As far as area, we're not exactly sure if there's more crime in one area or another because they're not reported as often. But we've been having reports of a lot of, you know, tropical fruit, especially rambutan, which is in season now, longan, lychee, as well as coffee in the Kau area and Kona area. But there's also avocado thefts going on, mangoes, citrus fruits. So it's an island-wide problem.
And Shane, so it sounds like it's very difficult to do something about these crimes after the fact, and that's why you're focusing on prevention. Is that right?
Yeah, because if we can help the farmers be able to deter the crime, and that'll hopefully slow some of that down. So if somebody really wants to steal something, they're probably going to find a way to do it. But if it's hard for them to do it, then that makes that farm less of a target.
Shane, we spoke to earlier in the week Roger Kaivi, the president of the Kona Coffee Council, and he raised the point that no one steals something if there's not a market for them to sell it. How are you addressing that aspect of the theft, that there is a market for these stolen goods?
Well, that's where that move-in certificate would come into play. Right now, being that I just started, I'm trying to find out who are the brokers or which mills are buying or who's actually buying coffee that's possibly, like, as some of the farmers are calling it, hot coffee. Who's buying the hot coffee? I don't really know who exactly they are right now, but I'm trying to find out who they are.
It's an entirely different kind of hot coffee.
Exactly, yeah.
So, Shane, to conclude, if there's one thing you'd like the residents of Hawaii Island to know about this issue, what would it be?
Well, I would like everybody to know that, you know, whenever you're purchasing locally grown items, keep in mind that if it's a good deal, sometimes it's not a good deal because it might have been stolen. Make sure you know your vendors and maybe ask where it came from, you know, what farm it came from, and that we can support our farmers better.
And if anyone out there suspects that they've had an encounter with stolen agricultural products, what should they do, Shane?
They can call the police, or they can send me an email or give me a phone call.
All right, and we'll post some of your contact information on our website for anyone who thinks they have encountered that. Shane, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Shane Muramaro, the agriculture crimes investigator for Hawaii County. Before him, we heard Mitch Roth, the prosecuting attorney for Hawaii County. And if you've got a story about ag theft or anything else, we want to hear from you. You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email the conversation team at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. In today's Backyard Quiz, we talked about Kalaupapa and asked you what the name means. This isolated peninsula on the north coast of Molokai is effectively cut off from the rest of the island by a spectacular 2,000-foot-high pali. You're probably well aware of the infamous leper colony started there in 1865 and how it was transformed by Father Damien's ministry starting in 1873. But long before it gained its modern history, ancient Hawaiians farmed it and lived in Kalaupapa for Ahupua'a. Its broad, smooth, and gently sloping plain was ideal for agriculture, and its name is a practical reflection of its physical shape. Those early Hawaiians who first gazed down from the pali saw it as a broad, flat plain, and so they named it Kalaupapa, the flat plain. That's our quiz for today. Michael Clicks of Honolulu got that right, and if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
NOAA Fisheries is proposing to designate critical habitat in local waters for the main Hawaiian Islands insular false killer whale, a marine mammal that was listed in 2012 as an endangered distinct population segment under the Endangered Species Act. Jean Higgins is an endangered species biologist with NOAA, and she's with us to explain what that all means.
Thanks
for
having me, Chris.
Thanks for coming in. Let's first of all, what is a insular false killer whale?
An insular false killer whale is one of the marine mammals that we have here in Hawaii's waters. They're found in the delphinid family, so they're a toothed whale, mm-hmm. a large marine predator, a large blackish-gray whale that's sometimes known as a blackfish as well.
Mm-hmm.
They have a falcate dorsal fin about halfway down their body.
A what?
A falcate dorsal fin, like the triangular-shaped dorsal fin that uh-huh. you'd recognize on a dolphin.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. They're in our waters, they're about 4 to 4.5 meters in length, usually, for adult size. And they're a long-lived marine mammal. They're very social. They feed cooperatively and work together.
What has led to the decline in their population?
There's a lot of information suggesting that they had a historic decline, and there may be several threats that may have led to that. It could be actually having to do with competition with fisheries, interactions with fisheries, habitat degradation, and disease even.
What are the causes, for example, of habitat degradation at the depths at which they live?
So for false killer whales, habitat degradation probably has to do with prey supply, so how many fish are available for them to actually eat, the size of the fish that they're eating, and really whether or not they have that supply available for growth.
So they're in competition with fishing.
Yeah, they are in competition with fishing when it comes to they are a large marine predator. They're actually feeding off of pelagic fish and squid.
Mm-hmm. Are these near shore waters? Where are the waters that we're most concerned about?
So for our insular population of false killer whales, it is near shore waters. But for a false killer whale, they actually live offshore. So it's not in the near shore waters that you and I use for recreation necessarily. It's mm-hmm. in depths that are deeper than that. So our proposed designation actually is from 45 meters in depth to 3,200 meters in depth.
So this isn't likely to affect recreational use of the ocean?
No, not at all, actually. A critical habitat designation is actually really directed towards federal agency actions,
mm-hmm.
Those actions that they're carrying out, that they're funding, or that they're permitting. And the protections under the Endangered Species Act that are specific to critical habitat actually requires federal agencies to make sure that they don't destroy or adversely modify critical habitat. And they do that by working with the National Marine Fisheries Service and or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when it's animal under their jurisdiction to actually make sure that the things that they're doing to manage and minimize impacts to the environment are actually going to be helpful for false killer whales.
Who would be likely to oppose your proposal?
I think most of the time people are just concerned about the proposal because they think that it could accidentally impact their activities. So
yeah.
If they're not involved with those types of federal actions, this designation actually won't apply to them. So that can be a misunderstanding that we often have with critical habitat.
Yeah.
And other folks who have concerns about critical habitat designations actually have to do with whether or not the designation may change how they consult with the National Marine Fisheries Service. So those are larger federal agencies. And a lot of times that's just questions about how do they do the analysis to consider their activities.
How do you go about informing the public about issues like this? Well, by doing what you're doing now.
Yeah, I guess we do it by doing talk shows like this. We actually put out all sorts of flyers and outreach information. We're actually doing a public meeting on December 7th here on Oahu,
uh-huh.
and it's an opportunity for the public to come in, hear a presentation about this designation. They can ask questions, and if they have testimony that they'd like to supply, we're actually taking public comments until January 2nd on this proposed action.
When a species becomes endangered, there are different stages of endangered, right? Endangered, critically endangered.
So under the Endangered Species Act, we actually just do threatened and endangered, but there are other authorities that use those different titles.
Mm-hmm. What are the criteria? I mean, how do you assess something like that?
When we actually looked at the false killer whales, critical or whether or not it was endangered, what we're looking at is how viable this population is over a time period and whether or not certain threats could potentially drive them to extinction.
Mm-hmm. But and you monitor that how?
We usually work with other stakeholders and researchers to try to look at this population. So we have a lot of partners who actually are working with us to do photo ID work. They do all sorts of tagging and actually looking at research on this population so we can get an idea of what's going on with the population, whether or not they may be declining, whether or not they may be recovering.
It seems as if tagging and other means of doing a census of marine populations has gotten a lot more sophisticated.
It definitely has over the years, but I don't think that actually makes it any less complicated. It can be difficult to get information on these marine populations.
But you're pretty confident of the information that's come your way in regard to this particular species, yeah?
So we have a lot of information that we looked at the historic declines on the population. Right now, we are still trying to get information about what the population's doing right at this present time. So we don't have a lot of information about trends of the population now. We think that the population's around 150 animals, and we're trying to determine which direction that's headed.
Yeah, so that would be one of the more difficult challenges of this, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a challenge in recovery planning for the species, and we're definitely having to work with other stakeholders to try to answer those types of questions.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what kind of answers you get, won't it, Jean?
Yes, I will.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Jean Higgins is an endangered species biologist with NOAA Fisheries Protected Resources Division in the Pacific Islands.
This season in HPR's intimate concert space, four of Hawaii's top jazz pianists bring their unique stylings to the Atherton's magnificent Bösendorfer Grand. On December 9th, Tommy James performs the works of film composers. Think Henry Mancini, Johnny Mandel, and more. Visit hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Yesterday on Giving Tuesday, we welcomed 36 new members to the HPR Ohana, and their enrollment brought us that much closer to our year-end goal of 300 new members. Thank you to Rui Hugh of Honolulu, Dominique Gogas of Honolulu, and Cassandra Quaintance of Pauilo. Every gift and every new membership counts, and if you'd like to help us with your gift today, please donate on the HPR website, our mobile app, and many thanks to all of you. That's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll be taking your calls about the state of our mental health care system in Hawaii. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you missed any of this show or want a past show, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.